This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me David Batker. He's the co-author of an important book with John DeGraff called What's the Economy For Anyway? And the subtitle is Why It's Time to Stop Chasing Growth and Start Pursuing Happiness. They've also put out a film by the same title, What's the Economy For Anyway? David Batker, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you, Matt. Very happy to be here.
Yeah, it's fun to have you here in the studio, and you raise really important issues in this book. But tell me, before we get to it, a little bit about yourself. There's an account in the book where you say you were working as a geologist for a coal company, and you had a bit of an epiphany. Can you describe that?
That's right. I worked at the Centralia Coal Mine in Washington State. It was the fifth largest mine in the country. They had 10 seams of coal, and they only mined three. Seven were totally wasted. And the bottom seam was one of the seams that they mined. And so we calculated the life of the mine and that it would last maybe 140 years if you mined all 10 seams, or just 40 years or so if you mined only three. And when I went to the management and said, look, this mine is going to run out if you keep mining it like this, they said, well, we make 1% more profit this way. And that didn't make sense to me. 1% more profit over 40 years versus 1% less over 140 years. And I just thought about how we use resources, how we look at water and everything else, and the short-sightedness. And I decided, that's it. I'm not going to devote my life to geology. I need to go into economics. And I went to graduate school in economics.
And how'd you get from there to where you are now? You're the executive director of a group called Earth Economics.
Well, I went to graduate school in Louisiana and looked at the hurricane protection value of the wetlands, and then had a short internship and worked a bit at the World Bank, and then interestingly worked for Greenpeace International, and that sent me to many different countries, many places, looking at really development economics and also the impact and devastation of the environment on a large scale, and what really builds an economy and real wages and such. And I had some time in the Philippines as well, and then came back and formed this group to look at what we consider kind of a new vision.
Interesting you mentioned wetlands, the protective value of wetlands in Louisiana, because, of course, Hurricane Katrina brought that to everybody's mind. What was your reaction when you saw the devastation of Hurricane Katrina?
Well, it was certainly not unexpected. In fact, it had been planned for and predicted. I was there immediately afterwards and called down by my old colleagues. And one of the interesting things, of course, it was devastating, horrific to see people, you know, going through the houses, marking it with orange paint where there were bodies found or not found. 1,400 people died, $200 billion worth of damage. That resulted because we lost 1.2 million acres of wetlands. And wetlands take 1 foot off of the storm surge of a hurricane, this huge pile of water, trillions of gallons of water, for every 2.5 miles of wetlands. Well, we lost 30 linear miles of wetlands that guarded New Orleans. And so the coastal communities of Louisiana and 2.5 million people and all the economic value there are not viable if you don't have those wetlands. And it took about two more years, and the Army Corps of Engineers started sitting up and saying, good heavens, if we don't have wetlands, there's no way we can defend these levees. In fact, the levees will be demolished. And so there has been some significant change. And finally, we're starting to say we need to measure the value of natural systems, the economic value they provide for things like hurricane buffering, flood protection, drinking water, et cetera. And that's part of what we do.
And that's part of what's not calculated in standard economic measures like the GDP. And so you go at that in this book, What's the Economy For Anyway? What is the problem with these measurements other than this not taking into consideration nature?
Matt, the GDP started as a heroic measure. Without the GDP, we probably could not have won World War II. Because with the GDP, we mapped out where copper was produced, how much it took to produce airplanes, etc. And so the United States, one of the secrets of the United States' efficiency at producing goods and things in World War II was that we knew where they were produced because of the GDP.
I mean, it was amazing that we didn't know that beforehand.
Exactly. Yeah. In fact, but prior to the 1930s, we had no measure of GDP, no measure of inflation, no measure of the money supply. We didn't know how much money we put out. This was a part of the crisis of the Depression. So we had no macroeconomics. So think about this. Prior to that, we had only microeconomics, the study of markets, firms, households, demand and supply. That economics was found to be totally lacking. We didn't throw it away, but we could not manage a national economy that way. And so with the Depression and the New Deal, we got new goals, like let's produce more stuff, let's reduce unemployment, new measures like GDP, inflation, unemployment, etc., new policies, new institutions like new agriculture policy and Social Security. But now these same measures are again obsolete. And we're having an economy fall apart. The GDP, because it's only based on the market goods and services, how much you spend on them, doesn't really measure what we actually produce, in fact. And so if you want to help the GDP, you should go out, get yourself in a giant traffic jam, sit there in traffic, burn gas, pull into the highest priced gas station on the block, fill up, and ka-ching GDP. And if it, in fact, if you'd like to do more for the GDP, perhaps you get in a wreck on the freeway and they have to haul your car off and you got to buy a new car and insurance goes up. And if you got injured and sit in the hospital for a month, well, you're not better off. But ka-ching GDP, the GDP goes up. So one of the problems is the GDP measures costs, damages, in with benefits. And that is no longer a viable way of looking at the economy. So we entitle ourselves Earth Economics, and we feel that everything that the progressive, in fact, has represented is let's move forward with looking at new goals of sustainability, of fairness, of how we produce the greatest good for the greatest number over the longest run in this country. And that was Gifford Pinchot the First's, you know, declaration of what the economy should do. And that's what we should be measuring and setting policies toward.
And are those things measurable?
Definitely. It's very easy. Like, there's sort of an academic debate about, oh, can you measure sustainability? You know, it's troublesome. But that's sort of like democracy. You know, you know when you're getting it and you know what's getting in the way of it, like corporations with unlimited contributions. And so we worked, for instance, on the spot prawn fishery, and you can very clearly measure sustainability when you look at spot prawn harvests and such. And that's the same with climate change. It's the same with flood protection, same with drinking water, et cetera. So when it comes down to the science of it, you can measure sustainability. Same with equity and fairness. And the same with the sort of the greatest good. What makes us better off? And that's, you know, why we have a chapter on happiness.
Yeah, it's interesting that you return to the pursuit of happiness, that great expression in our founding documents. I'm speaking with David Batker. He's the co-author of an important book with John DeGraff called What's the Economy For Anyway? And there's a film out that they did by the same name. I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. Happiness gauges. There are these studies out about what countries have the happiest people and the societies that are happiest. And where do we rate and who's on top?
We rate not too badly, but certainly further down. In other areas, we're, you know, 42nd in infant mortality, et cetera. In happiness, we're kind of in the top 10 there. But Denmark is on the top. And in fact, Scandinavian countries seem to be far outweighing us in happiness, and we're on the decline, sadly. And one of the problems is that we find that people are happier when they know they have health care, when they actually can relax about retirement, that they have a retirement structure that's going to support them. The greater the uncertainty, the less happy, in fact, people are. And happiness is a very interesting science. I mean, the U.S., it seems as though we've gone from a country of life, liberty, and now it's the pursuit of, forget it. You know, we should be focused again on happiness. That's why if you look at surveys within the U.S., people are less interested in more income and more things and more interested in having more leisure time and more time with their families and their friends, having a nice environment, etc. And those are the things that contribute to greater happiness.
But right now in this economy where so many people are still out of work, I mean, you have you quote the common phrase, you know, you should be happy you just have a job. And not that you're endorsing it, but that's the general attitude out there. And it is astonishing the number of hours that Americans work who have jobs. I know Juliet Shore did a big book, The Overworked American, on this now almost 20 years ago, I suppose. But it's true. I mean, the Americans work harder, longer hours than anyone.
And it's incredible, because until the 1970s, the U.S. has the lowest working hours, except for France with a 35-hour work week. But the U.S. had the lowest working hours in the world, the highest productivity, the highest wages, and the most vacation. Isn't that incredible? Now we have the highest, we have topped Japan in working hours, which seems incredible. And, you know, if our goal is to have a little more leisure time, if the economy is saying build the GDP and you need to be working 65 hours a week and somebody else needs to be unemployed while you're working 65 hours a week, well, one, the person working 65 hours a week cannot have more leisure time. They are not going to get it. And the person who's unemployed, of course, is stuck out there unemployed. So we need to look at policies where there's more flexibility in working hours and where we more rationally reduce working hours and quality of life rises and actually productivity on the job rises.
Yeah, you talk about ways to do that. Germany had a way during the recession. It didn't lay people off. It just reduced their work week and had the government pay the share of unemployment that those workers were in. And that seems a lot more sensible a way. And also on vacation time, there was something in here I had never seen, which was President Taft in, what was it, 1912 or something like that, saying that we should all have 3 months vacation.
That's right. Isn't that amazing? It was once a vision in this country to have 3 months off, that every working person should have 3 months off. And if you think about it, Matt, we are so much more productive today than 1912. And so, in fact, we can afford to have more time off. And look at Germany. Germany has a robust manufacturing sector. They give people 6 weeks of vacation. They love their vacations. And how is it that in the U.S., we still have 30% or more of the working population that has no vacation every year? And I think this is one of the things. If you look at policy in the U.S., we were the leaders in saying we're going to reduce working hours. We're going to make sure people have time off. We're going to look at fairness across so that we build real wages. We have a more equitable distribution of wealth. Under Eisenhower, we had 94% income tax on anyone earning more than $1 million. How about that? We built freeways that way. We paid off the debt from World War II, etc. So the thing is that now we've fallen behind. Now we see these policies in Germany. Take maternity leave. The U.S. is one of four nations in the world that doesn't have maternity leave. Lesotho, Sierra Leone, and Papua New Guinea, and the U.S. How can we do this? This is why we have high infant mortality. When a child can stay home with their mother for 6 months or a year, you have lower prison rates, greater education, greater health for children. This is science. This is knowledge. It is not ideology. And we should have maternity leave.
Yeah, that seems pretty basic. I mean, I was struck by that list in this book, What's the Economy For Anyway? And also, we're one of the few countries in the world without paid vacation time, too. And so we're, as you say, the United States led the world in humanizing capitalism, if you will, during the Progressive Movement and during the New Deal, and even during Eisenhower's day, and even in Nixon's day with environmental protections. And yet we've fallen way behind. Why?
It's ideology. And I think ideology is the enemy of the successful economy. And whether you talk about the Soviet Union as saying, oh, well, we're not going to believe genetics and we're going to have agriculture based on something else, which caused, you know, millions of people to starve, or an ideology that says government is bad, period. We should kind of get rid of government. And the idea that, you know, national health care is bad. In fact, we need to look at what performs, what works, what built America in the core of the progressive movement. And what I love about the Progressive magazine as well is that it's pragmatic. It says what works. Let's look at what works. Just like maternity leave works. Healthcare, national healthcare system works. Education for all with public schools works. And so we need to come back to actually what works. And I think as long what we've built is a very dangerous ideology. And let me just give one example. Policy counts. In the financial crisis, 350 banks went bust in the United States. $9 trillion of value was erased from working Americans' retirement, from people lost their jobs and such. Canada, neighboring Canada, no banks went bust, not one in the financial crisis. And that was policy.
What did they do differently than we did?
They basically, they required a higher reserve requirement. So that's the money that you have to hold as cash on hand in a bank. In the United States, it was 10%. In Canada, it's 20%. And that means that when you have a financial crisis, you only have 10% there, and then it's up to the government to rescue you as a bank. Well, when you can lend out 90%, like in the U.S., you make a little more money as a bank, but it's less stable. Another policy was very close regulation in Canada. So the regulators were really on top of the banks, whereas in the U.S., it was sort of hands-off. It became like the 1930s a bit. So that was a second piece. And the third piece was the philosophy of the Canadian banking private sector, which said, we're going to cooperate with regulators. Whereas in the U.S., this huge push for deregulation, which devastated savings and loans in the 80s and then devastated our banking system and our population just recently.
And what do you make of Obama's reforms of the financial, and is there a response to the financial crisis?
That's certainly insufficient. And I think this is another lesson from history. If you look at Teddy Roosevelt in the progressive period, he swept away the economics profession that whose advice was laissez-faire, let monopolies do whatever they like, go ahead and mow down people. If you want to produce a medicine, we don't care, don't regulate it. You know, it could be neurotoxins and it's fine. And Teddy Roosevelt said, no, we're bringing in a smaller group of economists. 95% of the economists at the time were sort of laissez-faire. Then the same thing with Franklin Roosevelt. Most of the 95% of the economists with the Depression said, do nothing. The business cycle will bring us back. And he took this tiny group of macroeconomists who were kind of radical and said, you know, we're going to do something here. And I think Obama's mistake with appointing folks like Lawrence Summers was simply to say, we're going to go ahead and take the standard economics and try and fix things. And basically it was, you know, when people are paying 18% on a credit card and we're giving banks lending at 0.25%, well, of course banks are going to get better. But if you don't give greater real income to people and improve their lending situation, you can't improve it. So I think the challenge to Obama, if he has a second term here, is to, again, take economists who see a 21st century economy with rising real wages, sustainability, etc., and not the standard economics jargon.
I'm speaking with David Batker. He's co-author with John DeGraff of an important book and very accessible book called What's the Economy For Anyway? You know, when I was reading your book, you have this account of J.P. Morgan going to Teddy Roosevelt calls him into the White House, and I was reminded in the Ron Suskind book about Obama's first year when Obama brought the bankers to the White House, and it was a totally different scene. You've got J.P. Morgan coming in, and Roosevelt and Morgan's being arrogant and says, you know, have your person call my person, we'll deal with it. But what was Roosevelt's response to that?
Well, Morgan, in fact, had asked for the meeting because he felt left out that all this antitrust stuff was coming forward. So he called for the meeting and said, yeah, you let your man meet with my man and we'll figure this out. You know, we don't have to have this antitrust stuff. And Teddy Roosevelt said, that's why I didn't invite you in here before, and that's why you're not invited. I'm not talking to you. We're not arranging anything with your man and my man. But he was very clear in saying, I'm not against business, but we're going to have fair business. Trusts are going to be broken, period. And the government is not in the business of dealing with business. We regulate business. And it set the tone for the progressive movement and built a 20th century economy for this nation. And I think one of the problems, and then you'd look at Franklin Roosevelt. In his second election, he said, which was true, Wall Street and the banks hate me and I welcome their hatred. Because he basically said, we're going to crack down. We're going to have an SEC that really does throw you in jail if you don't abide by the rules and such. And that built, again, a 21st century economy. So I think one of the problems has been, rather than invite Wall Street in the door to help regulate Wall Street, we need much more. How do you reallocate capital to that, and that's a theme of the book. If you don't allocate capital to producing goods and services, your economy will fail. And just think about this. We trade $3 trillion a day, $3 trillion a day in arbitrage. That's currency trading. You don't produce a good, you don't produce a service. But you do redistribute wealth from working people to just a few people, and you can cash in quite a lot. A small transactions tax would eliminate that very quickly. And the same with this rapid turnover of stock trading. If you had just a tiny tax on that, it would eliminate it all, and you're starting to crowd that investment into better investments. And so there are few, our book is full of policy, and that has been one of the hallmarks of the reviews. And that's where we need to go again, just like the progressive movement in the early 1900s and the New Deal.
Very specific reforms you have there, not only in the banking sector, but across the board. Actually, one of them is to lift the marginal tax rates, not to Eisenhower's over 90% level, but just 45%. I wondered why you stopped there.
Well, that's a good question. Actually, we could go higher. Much of Europe is higher. And I think that is, you know, let's at least achieve 45%. And when you even have Warren Buffett and Bill Gates saying, tax me more, please, we ought to be getting there. And I do agree, probably overall, there should be a higher tax rate. And here's why, too. You have, again, an ideology that says, oh, if you tax the rich people, they won't provide jobs. And yet, look at Steve Jobs, for example. He wasn't taking his investment money and pouring it into the U.S. to produce. He's got Fox over there in China producing goods and services, producing the iPad and the iPhone, paying people 31 cents an hour. And so it's reasonable to tax the wealthy because, in fact, you're bringing that money back to investment in the U.S., whether it's restoration, rural investments, etc.
David Becker, what was your reaction to Occupy Wall Street?
I thought it's quite magnificent. I think it's really a very grassroots movement, and we have provided free books to Occupy Wall Street groups. In fact, I'm going over today to Occupy Madison to give them a book. And I think we can't ignore this. And one thing that is very interesting is just the language that Occupy Wall Street has used has been much more acceptable to the American public than if you looked at the beginnings of the civil rights movement and a number of other movements, which were very successful, even suffragettes. They did not have the popularity that Occupy Wall Street has in the country at the very beginning. And so I think it's time we better listen carefully. And I love in the current issue of The Progressive, Kalle Larsen, who was from Adbusters, that called for this in the beginning. And we met with him and talked with him, and he's highlighted our economics, in fact. But I think we need to pay attention to these movements. It's very exciting.
And why do you think it struck such a popular chord?
The common American is very upset with Wall Street, and it's reasonable to be so. Because, again, if you look at, for instance, the Depression, if you don't allocate investment and capital well within an economy, however it's allocated, then you're going to go downhill. And in the Depression, John D. Rockefeller is a great example. So instead of investing in oil, he was putting $65 million a day into these call loans in Wall Street. And so Wall Street, with poor investments, but by redistributing wealth within the U.S., you know, was basically building this giant bubble, and it popped. And the same thing has happened here. We sat there, we invested trillions of dollars in devastating investments, whether it was credit default swaps, et cetera, and that devastated our economy. And so their call to get cracked down on Wall Street and not abuse America's savings is, I think, rings true to people, and it should.
You also, David Becker, have other ideas for making work easier, giving us more leisure time. One thing that struck me, maybe it's because I'm getting older, is that you have this idea of not total retirement, but partial retirement. Why don't you talk about that a second?
That's right. In many places, there is sort of a partial retirement, and that is a good path, because a lot of people, of course, still have a lot of wisdom to share. They enjoy an amount of work, and why can't they work 4 hours a day or a little bit less even, one day a week? And that is a reasonable way to advance that knowledge and education, but also open up working opportunities for younger people and such. And so, you know, when I think it was Bill O'Reilly said, you know, if he was going to get taxed 50%, he wouldn't work. Well, great. Tax him 50%. Get him off the job market. Somebody else will take his spot very easily and would be willing to pay 50% of their income for taxes. So,
especially his income.
Exactly. So as far as that goes, I think if people are, if some of those managers are unwilling to work at getting taxed at that rate, well, great, let them retire. And but it was to have that flexibility in markets. And this is not outside market economics. What's curious is, you know, this is an area where we're using markets to their advantage. Markets are neither good nor bad. In and of themselves. Like, we had a slave market. We needed to ban that market, ban the trade in toxic waste, etc. So markets need to be properly regulated and used correctly. And the labor market, where you have some flexibility in retirement, is a good idea.
David Backer is co-author of What's the Economy For Anyway? We only have about 3 minutes left. The political question is, you've got all these great proposals here. All of them make sense to me. But how do you get from here to there? How do you get these enacted?
I think looking at 1912, here we are in 2012. 1912 was an amazing period. The Progressive Party lost the election, and yet their program of women's suffrage, income tax, which the farmers pushed, greater labor protection and unions, which urban workers wanted, clean government, huge movement for that. All that was accomplished. It's really incredible what was accomplished, despite the fact they didn't win the election. I think, again, the progressive movement has got to melt down these silos, as many have said, as you've said before, Matt, and we need to come together. And there needs to be a vision for rural America. Right now, the message to rural America is you need to work harder for less pay, forget retirement, get rid of your health care, you know, and such. And because there have been declining wages, it's become a beggar thy neighbor approach. In other words, oh, those government employees have health insurance? We need to take that away, instead of a vision of rising all boats. And I think that only when we come together with this, and we've had a little bit of experience with that in Washington State, looking at how we make watersheds more efficient, and we've had both the far right and the left come together and say, yeah, we need to look at flood protection, drinking water, et cetera, all together as a unit.
David Backer is also the executive director of Earth Economics, which you can find at eartheconomics.org. Tell us briefly what that group does.
Earth Economics, we look at mainly at natural systems like watersheds and how they produce values. For instance, we just completed a report here in Wisconsin on the value of wetlands for flood protection, drinking water, etc. In the past, we've only looked at levees and dams for flood protection, but actually forests, watersheds, agricultural fields provide far more flood protection. So, you know, we've got, so looking at these full suite of benefits, but the other piece for Earth Economics is right in line with this book. We need new economic goals, like what makes people actually happier, not just consuming more stuff, but leisure time, etc. How do we measure these benefits? What policies bring about this better economy? And finally, how do we change our institutions to improve that?
Well, that's a lot of work we need to do, but the blueprints for some of this work is in this great book, What's the Economy For Anyway, by David Backer and John DeGraff. David Backer, thanks so much for being my guest today on Progressive Radio.
Thank you, Matt, and thank you for everything that the Progressive has done to move this work forward.
You're too kind. And if you, the listener, want to find out more, go to eartheconomics.org.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.